Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Search up ABC Pacific Prepared to listen online or find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we are taking a look at the big stories from the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, higher fuel prices and rising cost of goods, we take a look at what the Iran war means for Pacific nations. Papua New Guinea is 1 year away from a national election, but the body tasked with running it say they've yet to receive fundings for polling. As the world marks International Women's Day, what does the Pacific need to do to encourage a new generation of female leaders? We'll hear what Hilda Heine, one of the few female leaders in the Pacific, has to say on the topic. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. As the U.S.-Israeli strike on Iran drew global media attention, the retaliatory attacks on its neighbors have affected Pacific Islanders living in the Middle East. In Dubai, the fallout has hit hard with Iranian strikes and intercepted debris damaging parts of Dubai's international airport and other iconic landmarks. Feletti Strixenpour is a Samoan New Zealander who's been living in Dubai and works as an educator. He spoke to the ABC's Finau Funua about what it's like on the ground.
What we've noticed is there have been some interception missiles which have been stopping those missiles from reaching their locations that they're aiming for. And so we're pretty fortunate in that sense that like a lot of the missiles haven't arrived. But it's been quite scary in the sense that, you know, you're still seeing missiles that are hitting other missiles out of the air, and a lot of the danger has come from when those missiles have hit those missiles, the falling debris. So a lot of the issues have not been actually the missiles reaching their location, but actually where they fall down, causing fires and things like that.
Have you heard anything? Heard any of the explosions or perhaps sirens? And have there been alerts from the Dubai government, or UAE government?
Yeah, there have been alerts sent out. Just about the government's actually been pretty good in regards to just being really clear with its messaging. It's about keeping close to shelters, and they let us know when there's about to be attacks happening. In that sense, the government's been really good and really supportive. We've been really fortunate. A lot of the infrastructure is still running. So even though, you know, we're staying at home, there's been a lot of things that have been, you know, deliveries are still able to happen. Supermarkets are still stocking. We still had the opportunities to kind of maintain the support that we need while we're home. So we're quite fortunate in that sense.
Have you heard any explosions?
Yeah, there's been loud, a lot of loud bangs, and a lot of that's coming from interception. So there's, you know, ground missiles in regards to like the local defense. And so a lot of the loud noises has been defense.
What's the reaction from the population of Dubai in general towards this attack by Iran?
I think there's just a general kind of sense of just uncertainty. In terms of like political stuff, the UAE sees itself as quite neutral. So I think in that sense, it's just people are just trying to figure out. They don't want bad things to happen to Iran with all the struggles the Iran's already going through. Internally. So I think they're quite aware of the politics. There's a lot of Iranians that live in this country.
And that was Feletti Strixenpour, a Pacific Islander expat living in Dubai, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Finau Funua. You're listening to Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company as we go through the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Most Pacific nations rely on oil for about 80% of their energy needs, making them highly dependent on oil for both transport and electricity. And with the Strait of Hormuz closed, there's fears of a surge in global oil and gas prices. Professor Stephen Howes, Director of the Development Policy Center at the Australian National University, told the ABC's Lucy Cooper that Pacific nations will also feel the impact of the war, but one country in the region stands to gain from the increase in energy prices.
Oil is a very important commodity for the Pacific, and in fact, on average, Pacific countries get about 80% of their energy requirements through oil. So other sources, renewable, coal, very small. So they're very vulnerable to oil. And of course, only PNG produces oil. So the others rely on imports and have very limited storage capacity. So the Pacific's definitely vulnerable to oil shocks, and that's what we're seeing at the moment. We've already seen the oil price go up by almost 10%. That's since the weekend, since the war started. But, you know, if we go back to, say, the start of the year when tensions started to increase, we see a larger increase than that. So definitely there'll be an oil price shock. And then the second issue that people are now starting to worry about is just a shortage of oil due to the disruption in the Middle East. And especially if the Strait of Hormuz is closed, and people are saying it is now actually already closed, then that could lead to a physical shortage.
You mentioned PNG. I mean, when we're looking at, I suppose, winners and losers is the best way to refer to it in the Pacific region. Is PNG really the only country here that might not remain completely unaffected, but definitely aren't as vulnerable as the other nations?
That's right. In fact, overall, we'd expect PNG to benefit from this. You know, in fact, PNG, we saw a sort of mini boom in PNG or an upsurge in economic activity in 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine. That was the last time when oil prices really spiked. And yeah, PNG is an oil producer, but more importantly, it's now a big LNG producer with the PNG LNG project that started about 10 years ago. That project is now producing a lot of tax revenue and dividends for the PNG government, and LNG prices, like they're tied to the oil price, so LNG prices will also go up, and so definitely the PNG government will get more tax revenue, more dividends. It will be able to basically be able to spend. Also, PNG is planning or wants to have more LNG projects. There's a Papua LNG project that's next in the pipeline. It's not a done deal yet, but this sort of uncertainty in the Middle East will definitely drive the countries in Asia to look for sources, look more seriously for sources outside of the Middle East, closer to home, you know, where there's less risk of disruption. Of course, there is a downside, and you know, PNG does import oil, so it is at risk, but it is also the only Pacific country that actually has a refinery. So even on that sort of narrow front, it's sort of relatively well protected.
If this war is to continue on for a number of months, hate to say it, but even a number of years, what are those longer-term impacts the Pacific could really be impacted by?
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, first of all, we should stress that we still have very little idea how long this war is going to last. And it could be over in days, right? It could be over in weeks. And as you said, but it could be months and years. And so in terms of those longer-term impacts, I think, you know, the longer the war goes, the higher oil prices will go and the more risks there'll be of actual shortages. There's definitely a risk that a prolonged conflict could knock the world into some kind of economic downturn, if not a recession. If that does happen, of course, all countries in the Pacific will suffer, because you just think about, you know, how they earn their income, whether it's through tourism, fishing license revenue, investment returns, remittances, foreign aid, all those sorts of things will be at risk in the event of a global recession.
And that was Professor Stephen Howes, Director of the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University. And he was speaking there to the ABC's Lucy Cooper. Papua New Guinea is heading into elections next year, but the body responsible for running it say they've yet to receive funding for the elections. Deputy Electoral Commissioner Kila Vaname says she's concerned that with 12 months to go to polling, money for preparations have yet to materialize. Government has allocated $16 million for the elections, which is for updating the electoral roll and an ambitious plan to introduce biometric voting.
Currently, we are looking at potential solutions in improving the rolls while waiting for funds from the government. So the first step we have taken is, and it's in collaboration with relevant stakeholders, firstly looking at the world record book systems, and that's what we've started off with, collaboration with the DPLGA. And at this level, we have plans basically to display and verify the rolls at the world levels, at the urban and rural settings. And we'll also be engaging world recorders from the world to confirm the voter data. So that's currently in discussion. The other support that we're getting from is also seeking support from DICT for the service for voter verification and updating enrollment status. So currently that discussion is in progress. So we're looking at streamlining process like the voter registration, getting information like updating the enrollment status via SMS or the mobile app. So that's what we're looking at while waiting for funds. But these collaborations are already underway.
Will it be updated in time before April next year?
It can be done. It's doable. That's if we move quickly with key factors, including data verification and comparisons with the world record book. And also with the service wallet integration progress. And those are the verification drives and verification things that we're planning to do. So, the feedback from these agencies looking very, very good. And we are also extending our provincial discussions with the provincial administrations through the LLG and ward level. So that's basically what we are really trying to work towards and ensuring that they will get the support from all these agencies through these resources that they can provide.
Has the Electoral Commission been able to receive the funds it needs from government last year or this year to carry out its role for preparations? If not, how has this affected targets?
Okay, as we speak, no funding as yet. And we budgeted for this year, 190 million, but we only allocated 50 million to do these preparations. And we still living raising doubts whether PNGC will meet its target to roll out this voter registration and also concern about our logistical requirements and, of course, security. But we are working closely with these agencies to ensure that, they also support us as well. So we are in the progress of signing MOA with all the provincial administrations right across the country while waiting for funds. And that's it's really a concern for us now. We've set targets and outcomes and specific outputs, but the more delay in terms of funding, it will be problematic. Again, we might experience the same issues from past elections.
How realistic is the biometric voting in 2027 looking?
Okay, the biometric itself, that's partly our preparations towards the biometric. Then we also have implementing the biometric voting in 27 is government is so ambitious about it, but there are efforts underway to make it happen. And the government has initiated electoral reforms, which we are all aware of, focusing on biometric and electronic voting technologies to enhance transparency and credibility. So that's what we are looking at. But there are, of course, challenges that we could be confronted with as we undertake the implementation. So some of these challenges that we'll be looking at could be infrastructure and connectivity issue, and in that the implementation of the biometric, especially in the remote areas with limited network coverage and power supply, can always in the biometric data transmission and verification. So it is good. We're looking at it to promote transparency and credibility. We understand that we also have our voting, double voting, multiple voting. All these issues cannot be resolved, but only through biometric. We are confident that it can resolve that. But these are the big challenges that we have faced during the implementation.
And that was Deputy Electoral Commissioner Commercial Kila Vaname, and she was speaking there to the ABC's reporter in Papua New Guinea, Belinda Cora. Nearly two women in Papua New Guinea are tortured or killed every day due to accusations of sorcery. This is according to the PNG Tribal Foundation, a local NGO that works to end sorcery violence in Papua New Guinea. Its president, Gary Baston, says since 2022, his organization has supported more than 630 survivors, facilitated 149 arrests, and secured 14 successful prosecutions. He spoke to the ABC's Finau Fonua about the situation in Papua New Guinea.
It's getting worse because it's a copycat crime. People have started to realize that they can do this and get away with it. And that's why we wrote the law. In the areas where we're working and the arrests we're getting and all of that, the model is working and cases are reducing in those areas. And we work in several provinces across the country, but it's such a big job that we need all the support we can get. In PNG, about 3 or 4%, roughly, this is a rough number, of cases that are reported equal an arrest. Not an arrest, but a successful prosecution. So very few people are actually getting prosecuted. And that's the problem that we have, because if you want somebody's land or you want retribution or political power, whatever it is, you can accuse someone of sorcery, get people riled up, and then you can get what you want. And up until the last few years, very few people were being held accountable for that. The justice system in PNG is not receiving the support that it needs. There's not enough police officers, there's not enough judges and magistrates. And so all of that is very challenging.
Have you met the perpetrators, and are they apologetic?
Yes, many.
Do they really believe that these women, their victims are sorcerers, or are they apologetic? Do they admit that they were taking advantage of them?
So it's a mixed bag. There's people that rile others up, and they know what they're doing. But then there's simple-minded people in the community that are just doing whatever they think they want to do, whatever they're told. And so there's a mixed bag of people that are either using the simple-minded people in the community, because in PNG, everyone has a base-level belief in sorcery. And with the breakdown of society, people don't really know what they believe. They just know that they believe in sorcery. So whatever story that comes across, then it's believed. And so people use that to manipulate them. There's like the glass men and glass Marys that go around. It's their livelihood to get people accused. They come in the community and they get paid. And the reason why they do it is because that's how they're living. So they go to a village and say, I have special powers. I can tell you who the sorcerer is if you pay me. So the community already has someone they want to be accused. So then they'll pay this glass man or glass Mary, and then they'll confirm, yes, it was that person. So they're kind of brought in as an authority, if you will. And their authority is always based on a gimmick. There was one woman in Chimbu Province, and she said she had a little bumblebee that she made food. The bumblebee would tell her, you know, who was the sorcerer. We have a prayer warrior who said that Mary, the mother of Jesus, came and taught her how to pray, and she could see, you know, who the sorcerer was.
I've seen one video, and it's absolutely horrific. You have the community watching, and you hear the stories of torture, and it's a slow, painful death. So it's not not just killing the person, but it's about ensuring that it's extremely painful. Could you describe that? Why is that, and how the community just gets involved in it?
Yeah, so there's a story that they've told, the Glassman and Glass Mary have told, that someone steals someone else's heart. And the sorcerer, if they steal their heart, that if you torture the sorcerer enough, they can put the heart back. And so they're basically working off of that story, saying if we torture them enough and put them in enough pain, then we can get them to put the heart back in the person who's died. So it's, you know, it's ridiculous. And we've had a forensic pathologist even bring the people in and cut open the body of the deceased person and show that their heart was in there to the people that were making the accusations. And they still were like, well, they must have put the heart back just before you cut them open. You know, so there's a lot of folklore and just ridiculous belief associated with it. When you stop the accusation, then you stop the whole process. And we have a number of cases around the country now where we're able to stop the accusations in their tracks, where we just present the law, say we're watching you. So if anything happens from this case, you've already broken the law. So all we have to do is work with the police to come and arrest you.
That was PNG Tribal Foundation President Gary Buston, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Finau Fonua. The world marks International Women's Day this weekend. But in the Pacific, women hold only less than 10% of seats in national parliaments. It's the lowest level of female political representation in the world. But one woman who's broken through that barrier is Dr. Hilda Heine, President of the Republic of Marshall Islands. She first made history in 2016 when she was elected president, becoming the first woman to lead an independent Micronesian state, and then she was re-elected in 2024. President Heine says the process for getting more women into positions of power must start within the family.
Well, I mean, clearly it's not easy to become a leader in this region. As you put it in your introduction, there is less than 10% of women in leadership, at least in our political leadership around the Pacific. In the Marshall Islands, we're at 12%, and we just got into that 12% 3 years ago. But before then, it was always one woman represented in our parliament of 33 members. So it's not easy. I think part of it is we lack the confidence. Women lack the confidence, and not too many women put their names out there. So I think it's that. It's also a lack of financial support that would help women to really go after the seats in their communities. Fortunately, though, women have, you know, a lot of support from their families. So it's a matter of convincing families that you can do a good job. And I think in my case, family played a very important role in my election to parliament. Without their support, I would not have made it. So I think it requires us to work with our family, starting with our family, and you know, going further out there and getting support from women. In my case, also the women were quite influential in helping me gain my seat. As you know, I've been working with Women United Together Marshall Islands for a long time. And the women in that organizations were critical to my election to parliament.
What can we learn from you in terms of younger women? How do we get younger women to gain that confidence that you say is one of the two things we need to get into a leadership role?
Yeah, so I think, you know, of course, young girls need role models. And I've always believed that, you know, being in this position, I'm a role model for many of the younger generation, member of my Marshallese younger generation. And I think it's important for us to work with young women. We've had on a number of occasions through the WUDMI, bringing young women into our gatherings, into our activities. And I think more of that needs to take place to prepare young women to gain the confidence that, you know, they have what it takes to become leaders in their own communities. And of
Thank
course,
you
know, starting
much.
In families, starting in families too. I think families need to really encourage their women, you know, not always because, as you know, growing up, it's always the boys in our families that are encouraged to seek positions outside the family. They're the leaders in our families, and naturally, they become leaders in the communities. And so, I think within families too, we need to nurture young girls to become leaders in the families as well.
And that was Marshall Islands President Hilda Heine speaking there to the ABC's Live Movono. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review for this week. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific.